If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Dr. Rob Stahl bringing you the only local call-in radio program exclusively for older adults and caregivers. What should you expect at your age? The answer is a lot, and that's what we're here to explain. Today, I'm very happy to have with me attorney Laurie Menzies, a senior partner with the law firm Falscraft, Beinauer & Menzies, who, by the way, are generously sponsoring today's show, and a specialist in the legal issues of older adults. We also have Dr. Ralph Benedict, head of neuropsychology at the Erie County Medical Center. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Rob.
Hello, Bob.
The topic for today is a timely one, advanced directives and the determination of capacity to make healthcare decisions. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an elder law attorney, and also exactly what is an elder law attorney?
I have older parents. They don't mind me saying so. They're 88 and 81, and they had me when my sister and brother were approaching 20 years old. So they started their family all over again, and I grew up with people that really could have been closer to my grandparents. And so Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, and all of the old stuff was something that I just got used to, and I have a very easy rapport with people who are in their late 80s, kind of 70s and 80s, and I know where they come from. I did go into estate planning after graduating from Vassar. I moved to Boston and was working in the investment field. My clients were older, but at that point I was more interested in doing the estate planning for them and working with their attorneys, and what I found was a lack of communication skills in most of the attorneys that I was running into, and thought, you know what, if I went back to school, I might be able to do a better job.
Dr. Benedict, how about you? Let's start where you were born and what happened in those early years.
Well, my story begins in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm a graduate of Ohio State University, and I was I went into clinical psychology in Arizona State University, and it was there that I became very fascinated with the way brain function relates to behavior and psychological phenomena. I also discovered at that time that there was an emerging field called clinical neuropsychology. It was a small step from that point to join the residency program at Johns Hopkins, where I was for 2 years. And then I landed in Buffalo because they had a very good opportunity here to develop neuropsychology in the neurology department at UB.
And we have a terrific neurology department. We have world-renowned research and treatment for multiple sclerosis. We have some excellent practitioners, both neurologists and neuropsychologists. Now, why don't you just define how neuropsychology differs from neurology or psychology?
Well, it differs from neurology in that I didn't go to medical school. I'm a psychology PhD. And to be a clinical psychologist, the primary responsibility in learning is to objectively measure behavioral phenomena.
Now, what other diseases do you generally get involved with? I imagine stroke, and I'm sure Alzheimer's disease. And what's the range?
I commonly work with vascular dementia, Alzheimer's disease. There are other senile dementias that I see a lot of. Traumatic brain injury is something I commonly deal with.
The first half of today's show, I want to talk generally about what an advance directive is and why the determination whether a person can or cannot make their own health decisions is so important. Now, I want to give a brief overview of Terry Schiavo's case. She was born in December 1963 and got married to Michael Schiavo in 1984. She had an eating disorder called bulimia, which in February 1990 caused a chemistry imbalance in her blood, which resulted in cardiac arrest and severe brain damage. She was resuscitated, but has been in a comatose state for 15 years. Doctors verified that the brain injury is such that she will never again regain consciousness. In May 1998, Terry's husband, Michael, petitioned the courts that his wife would have not wanted to live in a comatose state being sustained by a feeding tube, which is what she had. This was based on conversations he had had with her, but nothing was in writing. unfortunately. Each time the courts ordered the tube to be replaced and put back in because of lawsuits brought by Terry's parents. Now, Dr. Benedict, what exactly is meant by capacity determination, and how has it impacted Terry Schiavo?
You can have capacity, for instance, to live independently, capacity to make decisions about something. The latter is probably most germane to the Schiavo case.
And you know, it's very interesting that you mention that, because in a nursing home setting, I've had the situation where someone's clearly able to say who they would want to make decisions for them, but they can in no way explain or understand specific health care issues like having a feeding tube placed or being put on a ventilator. So go on.
You're absolutely right. Capacity to refuse treatment, for instance. Capacity to refuse a particular medication. Capacity to designate someone as a power of attorney. Capacity to decide whether or not they should donate $100,000 to the Greenhouse Fund.
I have a question for the doctor, actually. When you were just speaking, you said that she was determined never to be able to regain consciousness again. That's my clinical question, is what is consciousness? I mean, you know, it seems like if you have functioning somewhere, you may be cognizant of your surroundings, not simply able to communicate back. It's a slippery slope, I would say, when we're starting to judge, you know, what level of consciousness somebody has by just looking at them, or is there a...
The doctors went further to say that she was really not cognizant of her surroundings, could not respond to external stimulus. There are things called locked-in syndrome where someone can't move, they can't express anything, but nevertheless, if you spoke to them, they can actually take in what you're saying, but there's no way they can respond to that. So that's one example of someone who appears unconscious and without any ability to think, but they actually can. But that's not the case here in Terry Schiavo's case, as determined by several doctors over many years. Let me get into the whole issue of advanced directives now. Okay, we talked a little bit about capacity determination, and the key issue there is, is a person able to understand and think about and respond appropriately to a specific question, whatever that question might be, and that there's different levels, like assigning whether they would want their daughter to make decisions for them if they're not able to, or whether they would not want to go to the hospital under any circumstances. Do they really understand that? They might understand one and not the other. An advanced directive first starts out in someone's mind, feelings, and desires as to what they want for themselves for the future. And we're talking specifically about healthcare matters, advanced directives for healthcare matters. Lori, why don't you talk a little bit about advanced directives? What is an advanced directive, and what different forms can an advanced directive take?
Let me go ahead and tell you how excited I am that we're having this conversation today, and that I think everyone who services the elderly in this community needs to have continued and more aggressive discussions so that we actually formulate a presence, that we're here and we know each other, and that we're there as a reliable resource for people who are actually negotiating this path of aging here in Western New York. An advanced directive means that you decide in advance of an incapacity what you would like to have happen if, in fact, you were to lose the ability to explain it at a future date.
One of the most important things to remember is that a healthcare proxy is a document where you designate who you would want to make decisions for yourself if you're no longer able to make decisions for yourself. In a way, that relieves a large burden on a healthcare agent, in that they don't have to think about what they would want at their point in life. Generally, they're a lot younger, 30 years, 40 years younger. They're not even thinking about death and the ultimate at that point. And it's hard to know when you're 40, 50, 60 years old what you would want when you're 80 years old. But if the 80-year-old parent writes down and says, I don't want to be put on a breathing machine under any circumstances. I want nature to take its course. When it's my time to go, it's my time to go. Then that healthcare agent merely has to reflect those prior stated wishes. And that's why having a healthcare proxy and also talking with that healthcare agent about what you would want under those circumstances is so important. And on a healthcare proxy form, you can also write in specifically what you would want. So it's very clear. I'm going to go through a hypothetical case right now that might help illustrate these concepts along with the Scheibel case that we've been talking about. And the scenario I'm about to read is slightly modified from a presentation Dr. Benedict gives when teaching health professionals. And here it is. An 83-year-old woman denies having any health problems. Her memory has gotten worse, and she has had periods of confusion. Her family was told 6 months ago that she had Alzheimer's disease. She says, however, she manages her own finances, can cook for herself, takes medicine as prescribed without assistance, and wants to stay living alone in her own house. One son claims that she is disabled and requires a guardian, but the other son feels that she's doing just fine and should be left alone. Dr. Benedict, where do you start with this?
The first question is, what's my role here? In a case like this, I need to do a couple of different things. One is, first of all, do a clinical assessment of the patient to get a sense of what her cognitive function is like. In this particular case, we determined, for instance, that she had very severe memory impairment, as well as other cognitive deficits in the areas of higher executive function, for instance, in language. There were periods where she was relatively high functioning and then had an abrupt onset of cognitive impairment. So it suggested that perhaps there was a cerebrovascular component to her illness as well as slowly progressing Alzheimer's.
So like having many strokes along the way that gradually chipped away at her cognitive function.
Precisely.
Okay. Let's clarify Alzheimer's and dementia.
Dementia is a clinical state. It just means that there are cognitive impairments in more than one area.
Okay, so dementia is problems with thinking ability, basically.
It's serious enough to affect what we can do in day-to-day life.
Okay, and Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia.
It's a disease that causes dementia.
Okay.
And there are hundreds of diseases.
Because there's often confusion about that. People are told that their loved one has dementia, and then another time they're told they have Alzheimer's. Which one do they have? So, okay. Now, let's get to the main issue here. This woman's living at home. One son feels that she needs a guardian. The other son doesn't feel she needs anything. What's the important thing for this woman? We want to help this woman and make sure that her life, one, is as functional as possible, two, enjoyable as possible, and also in this kind of situation, is safe.
Well, the safety issue and thinking about is she capable of living independently is largely determined by a physician's appraisal of her physical abilities and my appraisal of her mental abilities. And in this particular case, for instance, she claimed to be driving her car with some frequency, and it was clear from my assessment of her that she was not capable of doing that in a safe manner.
Actually, Dr. Stoff, I could jump in.
Sure, absolutely.
I think part of what we would be looking at would be an overall assessment by someone like a geriatric care manager who would then be able to bring in the neurological and the physical end, that the doctor would be able to see what their capacities were and then look at what all of the different available resources are in the community. That takes the burden off of the son's arguing whether she can or can't and who's got the keys, that you actually, and no one has to be the guilty party, that actually there would be an assessment done.
Well, exactly an approach I have in the office.
But there are other ways to, like, sort of take your life into a new and exciting phase. It doesn't have to be worse. It's just that it's changing.
Yeah, and, you know, there are geriatric care managers out there, and I think what you've done with your law practice by having a full-time geriatric care manager work with you in helping to coordinate beyond the financial needs and the trusts and what to do with that, to coordinate care, to go that step beyond just what a lawyer does, I think is key. Well, there's something called activation of the healthcare proxy. And that's when the person is determined not to have capacity to make healthcare decisions. And what doctors, other healthcare people sometimes fall into is bypassing the patient and going right to the healthcare proxy when the patient actually has not been determined to lack capacity and can still make decisions for themselves.
I think that's one of the most important things for all of us who work with people who are in the aging population, is that we remember who our clients are, and that when somebody calls my office and says, my mom needs a power of attorney, I need to know who's bringing mom in and whether mom is actually under her own volition asking for these things to be done, and that she does understand what's going on, and that she is my client, not the daughter who wants things to be done.
Now, we're coming up to the hour, so I want to wrap up. I think this has been a great session. Certainly, this could have easily been a whole afternoon seminar or a day-long conference. I want to thank again Laurie's Law Firm, Falsgraf, Beinauer, and Menzies for sponsoring the show. I'd like to thank my daughter, Lauren, 11 years old, who is very patient sitting here. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. See you then.
Many years from now, will he still be sending